listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm glad to have with me once again Dr. Quentin Henning. He is the chairman and president of Novo Resources, which has been my number one pick in my newsletter and my number one personal holding for quite a few years, last 3 or 4 years. Novo Resources trades in Toronto under the symbol NVO. You can buy it in the U.S., as I have, under the symbol NSRPF. Approximately 144 million shares outstanding, and it's traded in the range in U.S. dollars between $5 and $7 starting about early October. Recently at around $6 in U.S. money, giving it a market cap of around $864 million. One thing I would like to say before I say hello to Dr. Henning is that he is an out-of-the-box thinking geoscientist who, when conventional wisdom doesn't make sense, he has the intestinal fortitude to respectfully challenge it. And that is exactly what he has done with regard to the long-held views by geologists about how the famous Witwaters Rand gold deposit of South Africa was formed. About 35 to 40% of all the gold ever mined in the history of man came from the Witwaters Rand of South Africa, but conventional views as to how so much gold could be deposited there didn't make sense to Quentin. And about 13 years ago, Quentin not only explained why that didn't make sense, but he came up with his own ideas, his own hypothesis about how it could have, how maybe there could be an explanation for why there was so much gold deposited in a relatively small part of the globe. In studying rocks from the Witwaters Rand deposit, he noticed that gold was often associated with carbon material in what has been referred to as carbon leaders. From that, he surmised that early in the Earth's history, before oxygen was formed, the chemistry of the oceans was laden with gold and other minerals that would begin to precipitate out of ocean water as ocean water chemistry began to change with the creation of early plant life and photosynthesis. This, he theorized, may explain how so much gold could have been deposited in the Wits and possibly in other areas of the Earth's crust, and the right conditions for that to happen, he theorized, would be that the rocks had to be of a very old age, somewhere between 2.7 and 2.9 billion years, thereabouts, when oxygen was being formed in the Earth's history. And he looked for a large, shallow marine basin in a relatively low energy environment. Well, having worked as a geologist for Newmont Mining, Quentin had the opportunity to scour the globe to look for that kind of environment. And after many years of thinking about this and searching around the world, the place on Earth that he felt would most likely host another Witwaters Rand deposit, should it exist, would be in the Pilbara Basin in northwestern Australia, exactly because it had the right age of the rocks, and during that time of photosynthesis when it began to be formed in the U.S., when oxygen started to be formed, and because of its very large, shallow, low-energy marine environment. There are apparently other scientists who are trying to take some credit for what may be the most significant gold deposit discovery in decades, which of course remains to be proven, but whatever the outcome, it is Dr. Henning and Dr. Henning alone, as far as I know, who owns the precipitation theory for gold deposit for the gold depositions in the Witwaters Rand, and hopefully also, because I own the shares of Novo, in the Pilbara Basin of Australia. More and more, Dr. Henning's theories are beginning to be paid attention to, even by naysayer geologists, and one significant and profitable gold mining company, namely Kirkland Lake Gold, has invested a large amount of money in Novo, becoming its largest shareholder. In its quarterly report put out by Kirkland Lake last week, the company said the following about their investment in Novo Resources, and I quote, "We are very enthused about our recent strategic investment in Novo Resources Corp, with our investment having already increased substantially in value. Based on our assessment, we believe the Karantha area of Western Australia has the potential to become the world's next great gold camp, and we are looking forward to the results of the extensive drilling programs which Novo is currently undertaking in the area," end of quote. Well, it is this great growing belief in Dr. Henning's theories, as well as exploration results, that are beginning to bear, those results are beginning to bear out his theories, that has led Novo's shares from around 70 cents in early July in U.S. money to around as high as $7 earlier this month. With so much excitement surrounding Novo Resources and the discovery your company is making, Quentin, thank you so much for being with us again.
Always a pleasure, Jay.
Before we get started, I should mention to those of you who would like to understand more about the chemistry and geology behind Dr. Henning's theories, there are several research papers hosted at NOVO's website, that's novoresources.com, that you can access, and they will go far in explaining the legitimacy of the theories that Dr. Henning and NOVO Resources are basing their programs and their exploration efforts on. Dr. Henning, having talked about what took you to Northwestern Australia in the hunt for another possible Whitwaters Ran in the past on the show on several occasions, I would like today to focus on the content of your most recent press release dated October 17th. But before we go there, I would like to emphasize to my listeners that while some other academics may wish to take some credit for what's going on here, that it is really Dr. Henning's work and Dr. Henning's work alone. But, you know, nobody, even people of the most brilliant minds, always depend on some work that was done earlier. And Dr. Henning, you mentioned that although, you know, this, you are really a lone camper in this theory, there were a couple of professors early on in your academic life that got you to start thinking outside the box. Would you care to just maybe briefly mention that?
Yeah, sure, Jay. Look, actually, it's a pleasure to be able to talk about it because some of these early ideas, you know, kind of fallen out, you know, in history, you know, that people don't recognize them for what they were. But there was an effort in the late 1980s made by two people, Richard Vilhune and Richard Hutchinson, two very well-known geologists. Richard Vilhune was with Goldfield. He was head of exploration there for several years and is really a well-renowned geologist in, especially in Africa. Richard Hutchinson was my professor at the Colorado School of Mines. Richard Hutchinson is known as kind of the father of syngenetic ore deposits. He was one of the first people to work on VMS systems and such back in the 1960s. And he recognized, you know, this, the role that deposits forming in, say, seawater that were basically formed at the time sedimentation was being laid down, you know, how important these are in geology. Prior to that, people really had no understanding of syngenetic ore deposits, all right? So in the late 1980s, both Richards published a paper, I believe it was 1988, that hypothesized that the gold in the Witwatersrand Basin originated from an exhalative deposit. This would be called a deposit that was forming from hot fluids that were percolating up through the ground, a structural zone, call it, you know, along the margin of the basin. And then they issued out, you know, these basically vented into the ocean, precipitating a layer of gold-bearing pyrite. And that pyrite, gold-bearing pyrite, was then subsequently eroded and worked into the conglomerates to form, you know, we'll call it a syngenetic deposit, all right? So this was really the first foundation for anybody hypothesizing a syngenetic origin for these deposits. Now, in 1993, I believe it was, late 93, I was finishing my master's at the School of Mines, and Dick Hutchinson asked me to work on a PhD. He contacted Richard Vilhune, who was still at Goldfields, and Richard provided quite a few samples from various mines in the Witwatersrand Basin. They were all very interesting samples, you know, taken in context. They were from very special locations, carbon leader, you know, conglomerates that had eroded down through the carbon leader, the Wennersdorf contact reef. But anyway, long story short, it was an amazing set of samples that really told a geologic story. I started working on these samples as in preparation for a PhD, and unfortunately, Goldfields did not come through with funding at that time, so I had to park the work. But I got far enough along with the study to come up with some rather interesting discoveries. One of them was the recognition that the carbon structures, these are structures in carbon that's been preserved in carbon leader type material. Carbon leader is a thin seam. It looks like coal. It's a seam that's anywhere from, say, a millimeter up to a few centimeters thick, and it is absolutely loaded with gold. The carbon leader often occurs between a footwall sandstone and a hanging wall sandstone. In other words, there's sandstone above and below it. And it, you know, it's been a mystery. Like, how on earth do you form a sheet-like carbon seam that's full of gold over tens of square kilometers? You know, that's very, very odd. Some people have hypothesized this is kind of an oil seep, like it's oil that's been injected along a planar fracture, you know, through this bedding and stuff. And it's like, that doesn't make sense, because if you look at the carbon leader, it always fits a certain geologic context. In other words, it fits it fits in the deposition of the sediment. It doesn't transect beds. It's basically parallel to the beds, both below it and above it. And on a local scale, you can actually see structure in this thing. You know, you can see where it gets thicker and thinner, and there might be a few occasional pebbles that are embedded in it. And it was quite soft when it was formed because the pebbles actually dent. They bend the carbon material, you know, or the material that the pebble impacted. So I came to the conclusion, no way. This carbon leader was indeed deposited at an early time, and that this whole notion that it might be a fossil remain could be true. Now, there was a guy named Ter Halbauer in the late 70s or early 80s who studied this. He picked apart some carbon leader, and took some amazing photographs of this material, and showed that it was, in his view, microbial fossil remains. All right. So now, at that time, you must understand, geologists around the world had this view that there was no significant life on Earth at this time. So most people dismiss this as absolute rubbish. I came to the conclusion it was true. And what's more interesting is that I found in some of the conglomeratic ores that I studied, you know, these samples that I had received, there were pieces of carbon. These were not just little dots of carbon, like referred to as fly speck carbon, but they were actually what appeared to be chunks of carbon leader material that were basically physically disaggregating, like they were being broken up. They were detrital clasts in the conglomerate. I came to the conclusion, based on this, that the gold, the source of the gold, is actually the carbon leader. There was a precipitation event, and that formed the carbon leader, the gold-rich seam. And then the sea level, as it rose and fell, occasionally would rework this along the shoreline. The streams would start cutting down through it, and you would form conglomeratic ores. And then, especially in this near-shore environment where the waves work back and forth across this material. Okay, so fast forward. How do you explain gold in a carbon seam? Well, I started doing some work with some other researchers when I got to Newmont, and we found that the carbon in some of the samples that we studied was indeed kerogen. The kerogen means it's the carbonaceous material that's left behind after the material's been cooked. You know, it's kind of like the, you know, if you baked a cake too long, it would be the carbon that's left in the pan after you burnt it. Okay. What that confirmed is that it was indeed biogenic. It was indeed a fossil remain of some sort. And the notion is then that the gold was precipitated by this biomass early on during sedimentation. Okay. So the idea that I came up with was that oxygen, these were photosynthetic organisms, the top, biomass or the top bacteria on this mat was probably cyanobacteria, and it was kicking off oxygen. And oxygen has a way of breaking down gold complexes, causing gold to precipitate, right? So the idea is that this triggered a precipitation event. Gold was concentrated on this biomass as it was, this mat, as it was forming. And, you know, as the tide came in and out over years and years, you know, this accumulated enough gold to form this very, very rich gold seam. All right, so let's take that idea over to the Pilbara. You know, that's the whole impetus for going there. So let's find somewhere else where this process might have occurred.
And so you have, and you've gone there, and I know that one of the questions that's been raised so far is that, you haven't really found any of these carbon leaders yet, but I think your explanation for that is that you're still very high up in the system where there would have been more energy and more wave action, I guess, that would have broken everything up. Do I have that right?
Correct. You got to think of this as a dynamic system, all right? So we're in the shoreline environment where wave action was working this material back and forth. We're effectively in a relatively high energy regime. Now, what that's done is it's concentrated the gold in these conglomerate horizons, you know, and that's where we can get our first look here. We're drilling and trenching and so forth, and we're going to sort this thing out, hopefully, over the next few months. But, you know, in concept, if the carbon leader type facies are out there somewhere, they're going to be down dip, down into the basin, in what would have been a quieter environment where they're still preserved.
Right. And now let's talk about your drill program that you've got going on now, that you will have on shortly anyway. As I understand it, you're starting out with these narrow drills, I think 3/4 inch diameter core drills that are really being used primarily to determine the geometry of these conglomerate beds that host the gold. Do I have that right?
Yeah, it's a little bit bigger than that, though. We're drilling PQ holes. The diameter of the core that comes out is about a little over 3.5 inches.
Oh, that's what you're drilling now, 3.5 inches?
Yes.
The what you call the scout holes?
Yes, correct. The scout holes, these core holes are about 3.5 inches in diameter.
Okay.
And they provide us with a very good look at the geology. We can see, you know, as it's a stick of rock, basically. We can see the conglomerate layers, the bedding, the boundaries between, you know, layers above and below. So we're using this information to prepare for a large diameter drilling, which is 17.5 inch, that is designed to give us enough sample material to address the coarse gold issue here.
Right. So you got these scout holes, and I understood that you were going to start with a larger diameter drill later on.
Yes, very soon. In fact, it's showing up at site on Saturday afternoon.
What is the size of those? What's the diameter of those holes?
The large diameter holes are 17.5 inch, which is roughly 44 centimeters.
So essentially you're picking up bulk samples that way.
Correct. That's the idea, is to collect bulk samples, the material of which we can process and determine grade.
Now, you did one bulk sample so far, and it was remarkable. It showed, you know, I guess it was a little over 2 ounces per ton. About 80 or 84% of that was coarse gold, these nuggets and coarse gold, but a fair amount of it was fine gold as well. You know, as I recall, something more than 7 grams per ton, which is a pretty darn rich gold deposit by today's standards. And I'm wondering why you might not be assaying. Are you assaying this 3.5 inch diameter drill core for fine gold? If not, the nuggets.
We will be doing some test work on the core. I'm not going to call it systematic. It'll be where we see interesting intervals that might have a fine-grained gold component. We are not going to necessarily report those for grade purposes. The whole purpose of drilling the large diameter holes is to try to get a large enough, i.e. representative enough sample for grade. But we will learn some very important information out of the large diameter drilling, too, in regards to the fine-grained component. As we put the samples through the ore sorter, the machine actually picks out rock particles that have gold in them, all right? So it sees visible gold. It shunts those particles off into one bin. The other bin collects the waste material, and which is where the finer grain gold would be. And much like the results we got back in August, you know, people can go to that news release and read. We will have an idea of how much coarse gold and how much fine grain gold there is in these samples.
In your press release, there was a very interesting couple of sentences there in the fourth paragraph down, and I quote, it says, "A slight distinction is made between a lower sequence in the conglomerate that is nearly devoid of quartz and an upper sequence that bears up to 10% rounded white quartz class. Novo personnel have noted at surface that while the entire conglomerate sequence has been subject to metal detecting activity, most gold appears to be derived from the lower mafic classed rich conglomerate sequence." And when I read that, Quentin, I took it to mean that the lower portions of the conglomerate were perhaps you said they were more mafic like makeup was mineralized mostly, if not entirely, by a precipitation event that you theorize about, while the upper portion of the conglomerate, which displays some quartz mineralization, may have to a limited extent been mineralized by more traditional erosional activity. Perhaps am I reading too much into that?
No, let's pick it apart. Okay, first of all, the term you said mafic. It's actually pronounced mafic.
Yeah.
And what that is it means the clasts in that conglomerate are dominantly mafic igneous rocks. Mm-hmm. Okay. They're salt and dolerite and gabbro and things like this. We don't see much quartz in that particular horizon. Like, there's maybe an occasional pebble or two of quartz. Up section from that, the conglomerates start taking on considerably more quartz, maybe 10% quartz, and they're very distinct. Out in the field, you can see white quartz cobbles scattered across the ground.
Mm-hmm.
There's really nothing to read into the comment other than what we see right now is that most of the metal detecting activity that people have done is in the lower unit, which is the mafic-rich unit, versus the quartz cobble-rich unit. Okay, so it's just a way. It's just an observation. We can distinguish that most of the gold appears to be in the lower section of the conglomerate. It's not to say there's none in the upper conglomerate. There are occasional dig holes where people have dug up nuggets, but I would say the bulk of them, you know, 90% are down in the mafic rich conglomerate.
You've learned that these conglomerates are quite substantial in their thickness. Would you talk about what your press release revealed in that regard?
Yeah, look, what we've learned is the conglomerate horizon is very sheet-like and continuous. It ranges from about 4 to 14 or 15 meters thick in the drilling that we've done so far. The distribution of the two conglomerates, I would say, is roughly 50-50. But, you know, in any given hole, you might see as much as 80% of one type and 20 of the other. Okay, it varies from place to place. Mm-hmm. But I would say overall, we're seeing, you know, a roughly 50-50 mafic conglomerate versus quartz cobble-bearing conglomerate in each of these drill holes. So it's very encouraging. It's telling us that the thing is sheet-like. It was probably deposited in a shallow marine environment like we've been hypothesizing. And, you know, so far the drilling is supporting this.
Yeah, so, but again, what you're looking at so far would be higher up in the system, that is higher, closer to the shoreline, I guess, right?
That's right. We're still in the shoreline environment. You know, we did see a chunk of what is probably a fossil stromatolite in one of the drill holes. I think I have a picture of it in that news release that people mm-hmm. can view. You know, it's called a little taste of information we've gleaned here, but you know, there's lots more to do.
Quinton, as I understand it, the bulk sample that you took and reported on back in August would have been taken then from that lower portion of the conglomerate, right? And which would probably grade higher than the more than the upper levels of the conglomerate. Although, of course, this is just one bulk sample.
Correct. Yeah, it is one bulk sample at the time. You know, our understanding was much less than it is today. We're learning every day. In you know, to put it in context, I would say that first bulk sample came from kind of the upper to top part of the mafic conglomerate. So it's the upper or top part of the lower of the two conglomerates, mm-hmm. just the way it worked out.
All right. So now I believe you're doing these scout drill holes on 50-meter sections. Do I have that right? And then will the broader, the wider drill intercepts be at the same places? Will they be drilled at 50-meter centers as well?
Yeah, we're basically doing a 50-meter grid. So it'll think of it like a, you know, looking down on it from a bird's eye view, you'll see holes in 50 meter squares.
And when might we start to get some assays from that? I know you have to be cautious because you don't want to promise something before you can deliver. And there's a lot of things that are changing. And I understand that your lab that will be assaying these have had to make some adjustments for you as well. But when do you expect that we might start hearing and seeing some assays that might come out of this exploration program?
No, that's a good question. I want to set everybody's expectations. So the large diameter drill shows up on Saturday. We'll probably start drilling on Sunday. The first samples from that drill will hit Nagrom Laboratory in Perth. Today is the 20th, probably sometime in early November. Give it 2 months. 2 months. Nagrom's setting up their laboratory right now to handle our samples. So I would say early next year we'll see samples from the drilling. Trenching about the same. We did take about 20 or 30 trench samples here recently. Those are being shipped as well, and again, it'll be early next year, let's call it.
Can we look forward to any kind of announcements on an ongoing basis before assays come out?
Yeah, what we plan on doing in the meantime is issuing news releases describing the geology, what we're seeing on the ground, on a routine basis. That way people can, you know, keep engaged and understand how this project's developing.
Quinton, with respect to Beaton's Creek, I mean, so much excitement 350 kilometers west at Purdy's Reward and Comet Well, but what can you tell us about Beaton's Creek? Because the last I talked to you, the company was planning to do a pre-feasibility study. Is that still in the works?
Yeah, look, Jay, we have, so in order to do the pre-feasibility study, we have to revise our resource, and we are working on that presently. We found out our QP from the company we hired had left the company without telling us back in July, and so we had to find a new QP, which kind of put us off track for a bit. We found a new QP based in Perth, and he's gone up to site in late September. He's working on the resource revision now. You know, I'd say we're about a month behind on that, but we are still working towards the goal of revising the resource and ultimately doing economic study.
Yeah, because before all of this excitement out there at Purdy's Reward, I mean, this was something I was looking forward to. It certainly doesn't carry the excitement that you've got with the newest discovery, but it looks like something that might be feasible and might make some sense and might make some money.
I'm not going to pretend. Our bandwidth has been exceeded at times recently. It's been
I can imagine it has, Quinton. I thank you so much. It makes it all the more, I'm all the more grateful for you taking the time to speak with me today, given the pressure that you're under right now. How well funded are you to carry out? This is a very expensive exploration program that you're doing now with these wide drill holes with, you know, closely spaced and so forth. But are you well funded enough to, with Kirkland Lake coming in, I suppose you're okay, at least for the foreseeable future?
We are. Look, we're in very good position. That placement did us a world of good. We have about $72 million in the bank. We're starting to spend, we'll probably spend around $1.5 to $2 million per month for the foreseeable future as we advance the CareArthur project and our other assets. Basically, that's the company burn rate. So we have a lot of runway. We have a lot of runway. We can keep our head down. We can do the work we need to do. It's a delight to be able to focus on geology and not worry about going around and raising money.
Boy, I guess I can understand that because I've known you over the years when that wasn't the case and when I know that it was pretty difficult at times. But boy, you held in there, Quentin, and just stuck with your principles, with your ideas, and it seems to be paying off now. I mean, time will tell, I guess, but boy, we'll be waiting with bated breath, that's for sure, for the news to come out. I know many people are. Anything else you'd like to leave us with before we conclude our discussion today?
Yeah, look, I think what the comment I would make is this. You know, a lot of what's driven our stock recently is, you know, on the speculative side, people are thinking, wow, these guys could be onto to something truly unique.
Yeah.
And I firmly believe that. But the important thing is now we let the science catch up with that speculation. We have to do the hard work.
Sure.
To collect these samples and assay them and so forth. And that's really our goal. You know, a lot of people think that, you know, snap of the fingers, you got a billion ounces or something.
Yeah.
Craziness. And I really want to diminish, you know, that kind of speculation and try to pull it back towards the science end so that people understand how this is going to develop. That's why I put out news release like the one on Tuesday.
Yes.
It really informed people on what the science is behind this to drive the future value.
Yeah, it was very helpful. I want to thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it. And I'm so happy that I got my friend John Kaiser to start looking at this, too. He's really digging into it with a great deal of intensity, and he's very helpful to me as well. Especially, Quentin, I don't want to be bothering you all the time because I know as soon as we finish this, you've got another interview to go to. So I'm going to let you go now and thank you so much for being with us again. And I do hope, if you have time, that you'll come back and talk to us again in the future.
Well, thank you very much, Jay. Always a pleasure.
Folks, don't go away because coming up next, Richard Mayberry will be with me to talk about some very important geopolitical events taking shape that are likely to have a profound impact on the price of oil, dollar, gold, and your investments in general. So don't go away. We'll be right back with Rick Mayberry.
Noble Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Karratha region of Western Australia, where they are currently drilling and trenching their Purdy's Reward project. In addition, Noble has partnered with Sumitomo Mining Corporation to advance its Beaton's Creek Gold Project toward production. With over $70 million in cash and strong shareholder support from the likes of Kirkland Lake Gold, Noble is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.
A gold rush has begun. Recently, three of the largest gold mining companies announced strategic acquisitions in the Yukon Territories. Ahead of them was a group who had already consolidated the key claims covering the historic Klondike Gold Rush into one company, aptly named Klondike Gold Corp. Led by a team of accomplished geoscientists, the company is steadily advancing exploration to reveal the rich source of all that gold. The hunt for the next major discovery is well underway, and Klondike Gold's shareholders are strategically positioned. Stay ahead of the majors and follow KlondikeGoldCorp.com.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.